from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. We know the Disney version of European settlement in America is all prettied up showbiz, but we may not let ourselves see just how prettied up is our whole everyday narrative of that settlement. Those early years in Virginia's Jamestown, New England's Plymouth, the New Amsterdam that would become New York, and more. Historian Bernard Balin lays out a brutal narrative of what really went on in those settlements, those encounters. This hour, On Point, the barbarous years of America's first colonies. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's it mean if it was much, much tougher, darker than we like to think? Does it matter? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will listen back to a bit of our 2008 conversation with Nobel Prize-winning author Doris Lessing, who died yesterday at 94. But right now, the early, early years of American settlement. Joining me in the studio is celebrated historian Bernard Balin, author of The Barbarous Years, The Peopling of British North America, The Conflict of Civilizations, 1600 to 1675. Bernard Balin is 91 now and one of the country's most honored historians, a two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize, among many other prizes for his work. He's professor emeritus of history at Harvard University. Bernard Balin, welcome to On Point. It's Bernard Balin. It's very good to have you here.
Thank you.
So here we are. We're on the eve of Thanksgiving, and your book has just come out in paperback. And I had to laugh because I'm reading this and reading this and reading this, and there's no mention whatsoever of Thanksgiving. You have no pretty stuff in here, sir.
Well, they had frequent Thanksgivings when the occasions were right. It was common practice to celebrate good things when they happened with Thanksgiving feasts, and it was also set aside for lamentation when things went wrong. Mm-hmm. There was no celebrated first Thanksgiving, though they did have a great feast after the first year, which was well worth it, since in the previous year, the first year of their settlement, half of the population had died.
Half of those who had come on the Mayflower.
Those on the Mayflower had died, and half of the crew had died, and it was a miracle that they survived at all. But by the second year, they were beginning to establish themselves securely. And the first crops came in successfully, and it was precisely that kind of a day which would bring them to have a Thanksgiving. And so they did. And they had other Thanksgivings. And they never had a routine Thanksgiving every November. That comes much later in our history.
Of course.
It was a day in 1621 when they had their first success in their crops and their relations with the Indians, and they made a great celebration of it, not thinking of it as something unique.
You focus here on the stupendous difficulties that people faced. The European settlers in Jamestown and New Amsterdam and Plymouth and more, the Native Americans suddenly encountering these new people trying to build buildings, settlements on their doorstep. I wish you'd take us just on a little tour, because, as you say, you write in the book, you know, we have a kind of Williamsburg vision, polished up and gussied up. We should take us on a little tour of the terrors, the barbarisms that give us a sense of the harder side of these years that you describe in the book.
Well, it was overall an invasion. We don't think of it that way, but it was the European invasion of North America. That is really the story here, dominated by the British, but not only the British. The Swedes were there. The Finns were there. The Dutch were certainly there. It is an invasion of this native territory. And the book, this book, The Barbarous Years, is about an attempt to find out who exactly these people were, mm-hmm. what they did, and particularly how they lived and survived. And it is, as you say, it is not a pretty picture. There is never a time between the Jamestown settlement,
1607,
and the end of this period, when there was not warfare and bitter and bloody warfare with the native peoples somewhere between Maine and North Carolina. And these were extremely brutal encounters. It starts with a massacre in Virginia in 1622 and continues in successive waves encounters that go all the way through the period. But it isn't only intercultural warfares that are continuous. The conditions were difficult for all, and there were disputes among the Europeans, bitter disputes among the Europeans, in almost every one of the colonies. Of course, the Puritan struggles we know a lot about, but it was true elsewhere as well, especially among the Dutch, who had opposition, bitter opposition, to the establishment of the little colony from the beginning until finally in 1664, the English took over the Dutch settlements. It was a barbarous time. That is, they were engaged in extremely difficult circumstances. They were divided among themselves, and they were in almost constant conflict with the natives. There were naturally efforts, serious and important efforts, to work with the native population. And some people, like Roger Williams, for example, knew their language and tried to work with them. He lived with them, really, in what is now Rhode Island. But these were few encounters among many, and for the most part, the relations with the natives were extremely difficult. It isn't just the conflict with the natives that's at issue here, because they were divided among themselves, and the disputes within these little communities were in themselves matters of barbaric encounters.
And not just disputes, obviously. I mean, you write about Jamestown, what was it, the winter of 1609, 1610, and the extremes of starvation, the sort of mad extremes people went to in desperate attempts to survive. They're just mind-blowing.
It really, as I put it in a couple of places in the book, all three elements of the population, the Europeans, the Native Americans, and late in this period, the Africans, were struggling to survive and not descend into absolute barbarism. And I've phrased that in various forms all the way through this.
But here they're failing. They're struggle. Eating dogs and cats and rats and mice and each other in Jamestown.
Well, that was that particular starvation period before they were rescued. Mm-hmm. And in fact, one of the twists of that, which I had never seen before I came on it by accident, apparently at one point, you're talking about 1609-10, yes. In Virginia, they discovered that their ruffs had starch in it.
These collars that we're so familiar with that look rather grand, but
that's
they,
right.
They weren't by
and
the time they
boiled
got done
it,
with them.
They boiled the starch out to find something of some kind of nutrient to use.
Sort of glue or starch in the collar, the ruff. I mean, but that's the least bad enough, I suppose, but also digging dead corpses out of graves and eating them?
And there was literary evidence, and now recently we know there's physical evidence of cannibalism. But it is that part of it is a one small segment, mm-hmm. And of heightened horror during that year or so. But that is not characteristic of the whole period. What is characteristic are the divisions and bitter divisions within these communities, the difficulties survival under those conditions and the relations with the indigenous peoples. And that goes all the way through this period, and it is the basis upon which the growing American population takes form.
Is it important for us to carry a realistic understanding in our mind of this period?
Yes, it is. Partly because we want to know the truth.
Yes.
We want to know what's happened. To get into the detail as far as possible so that we know very clearly, as far as we can, who these people were and what they did. But beyond that, there is a legacy from this period that is of basic importance in the whole of American history. It is from this period that slavery, as we know it, chattel slavery, is formed in the middle of the 17th century in legal terms that for these people had not existed before. It was trial and error as they found their way towards what chattel slavery really became, namely the total degradation of a single people, the identification of that degraded status with a race, and heritable status of that condition.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are here today to get you prepped maybe for Thanksgiving. We're talking about the real history of the early European settlement of America, the really tough years, not the Disney version by any means. Bernard Bailyn is my guest, two-time Pulitzer Prize winner and author of The Barbarous Years, The Peopling of British North America, The Conflict of Civilizations, 1600 to 1675. As he tells it, it is very, very tough, beyond what most of us carry in our minds, even though we know it was not easy. Professor Bernard Bailyn joins me in the studio, and I see something's very much on your mind.
Yes. I want to continue what I was saying a bit before. Namely, you asked the question of why we should bother about this. Well, the first thing, of course, is we want to know what happened.
Yes, we do.
And we want to know—
Though you might argue not everyone does want to
well,
know.
But,
but yes, we ought.
On the whole, we'd rather know as far as we can what actually happened. But in addition to that, there are legacies that begin in this period and carry through long parts of our history. It is in this period, as I said before, that the condition of chattel slavery is defined. Slavery meant many things before, but chattel slavery, in the way we came to know it in later periods, was formulated by trial and error during this period until it became fixed as a totally degraded state, applied only to one race.
Is its emergence related?
Heritable in the maternal line.
But is the emergence of that chattel slavery somehow related to the suffering and difficulty that the first settlers found there? Is that the case you're making?
Well, they're developing a labor force as far as they can, and they would have preferred to continue what they had at the beginning, namely a white labor force of indentured servants. But for various reasons, economic and also the difficulty of a supply of such people, they saw gradually, but only gradually, they saw the value of a slave labor force. But what that meant had to be defined as they went along. And a legacy of this period is that definition and the beginning of the application of people in that condition to the plantation world. And a second legacy that comes directly out of this period is the encounter with the native peoples. While, as I said at the beginning, while there were efforts to live with them peaceably and to incorporate their lives somehow with their own, nevertheless, the conflict was directed to driving them from these lands west in a way that continued, as everyone knows, into our later periods of history.
You describe a huge outbreak and massacre around Jamestown, where those colonists who had been most at the forefront of trying to create relations with the Native Americans in that region were the most brutally slaughtered. The Native Americans seem to have singled them out for death. Who and why?
Well, it's hard to know precisely who were targets for this. But as the Virginia settlements went west, they began to infringe more and more on Native lands and hunting grounds and so. And so the attack from the Indians when it happened in 1622 was an attempt to push them back, not to eliminate them entirely. I believe that's the case, not to eliminate the settlers, but to push them into an enclave in the coastal areas that would be dependent on themselves. Mm-hmm. They almost succeeded in that. Several hundred, 300 plus of the settlements, and they were very small settlements, were killed. And the western and most exposed of the villages were destroyed.
They singled out some like Captain Nathan Powell, you remind us, who had been particularly open to the Native Americans for special butchery.
Well, it's hard to tell, but that is a case in point, and there were others. It's a more general thing than individual targets.
Were they trying to say, let's not mix, let's not pretend we're friends here, perhaps?
Well, they weren't thinking in those terms. Mm-hmm. They were thinking of survival for themselves under these conditions and did what they could to protect themselves from what they gradually came to understand was a force that would destroy them. And their struggles were an effort to survive also, just as for the Europeans, those encounters were an effort to survive.
The force they were up against in Jamestown was quite different, of course, from New England. It was companies back in England, back in London and beyond, that were looking to make fortunes in the New World. You described them scouring, among other places, the slums of London to find and sort of scoop up, almost dragoon, I guess the poor and even children to send into this, what comes across as a hellhole in your description.
Well, they were gradually getting civil communities started, but the population was low and they did what they could to recruit. And those recruitment efforts in England, and they took different forms among the Swedes, those recruitment efforts did go into taking up the vagrants they could get hold of and ship them to the colonies. And there were suggestions that be done on a wholesale level that wasn't quite accomplished then. In the 18th century, there was more of that through the criminal justice system. The population growth in the Swedish areas, for example, which were always very low in numbers, really came out of the leaders of them, people who had a choice of punishment if not crimes, as they usually were, as they thought of them, but of
offenses on someone's terms back in Sweden.
Offenses of some sort. They came to the little Swedish colony. They were sent to the little Swedish colony on the Delaware.
The Delaware River, Swedes and Finns there.
But, Tom, I should say to you also that while all of this is true, what we've been saying, all the way through this area, there's a strain of utopianism that is extremely important. We know about it in the case of the Puritans. Mm-hmm. We know about it in the case of the Pilgrims and their hope for a sacred apostolic conventicle that they could live quietly by themselves as they thought the apostles did.
Right.
There is that strain of utopianism that goes through much but not all of this history. In Maryland, for example, what becomes Maryland, mm-hmm. Was thought of initially as a kind of refuge for Catholic gentry who would build around them communities, around estates of the larger planters. And it was thought of explicitly in those terms by those who planted the colony. And then you get, if I can go into mm-hmm. so much detail,
yes.
I don't know if...
Yes, please.
If you want to get into that. But one of the most intriguing episodes of utopianism mm. Through this period, to which I devote half a chapter, is almost totally unknown, but in its way, I think significant. It has to do with a Dutchman by the name of Peter Pluckhoy, mm. who was an intellectual from Amsterdam, who tried to devise and wrote extensively about a perfect communitarian society. His writings were in Dutch and in English, and he tried to create a perfect communitarian little society that could be kept in that condition. He tried to establish it in Europe and failed. He tried in England and failed. And through his brother's connection, he finally decided to establish it on the Delaware River. And in 1663, Peter Pluckhoy's little settlement, as utopian as the Pilgrims, but very different, mm. was settled on the Delaware River, and they lasted for a year. In 1664, the English conquered this whole area of the Delaware River, and they destroyed the community, as they put it, to a very nail.
Gone.
And it was gone, but it wasn't gone. Mm. And what's so interesting in contrast with the Pilgrims is that the ideas lived on. The ideas, Pluckhoy's ideas of a perfect community was picked up by the Quakers at the end of the 17th century. And from the Quakers, it was picked up by reformers in the 19th century, including the Marxists, some of the revisionist mm-hmm. Marxists who picked it up. And in 1986, the French École des Hautes Études got all of Pluckhoy's writings together, translated them into French, and established the corpus of it as a basis for the sophisticated discussion of communitarian worlds.
Beautiful now, aspirations here alongside all this suffering and hellishness.
And they were wiped. The last one knows anything about Pluckhoy's settlement, by the way, was some trace of his son who was blind and who was taken for a charity case by the German pietists in the end of the 17th century. But the point is that while neither Pluckhoy's perfect community nor the Pilgrims in the original form, while neither of them survived physically in the way they had intended, Pluckhoy's ideas did. And they survived
across
to
centuries.
Nourish the kind of reform movements in the 19th century, which, of course, the Pilgrims did not. The Pilgrims did not have an elaborate theology at all, as the Puritans did. They were simply thought of themselves as simple apostolic Christians who wanted to live alone for purity's sake.
I'm not sure that's a dead impulse, but it was certainly challenged. You write, 1620, Bernard Balin writes, in the barbarous years, death was everywhere. America, for these hopeful utopians, had become a graveyard. And there we're talking Pilgrims. Let me begin to sneak our listeners in for you. We've got many waiting for you. Amber in Parksville, Tennessee. Amber, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Just wanted to say I listen to y'all show On Point every morning after I drop my kids off at school.
Great.
So, but no, I love history. I'm an agribusiness major, but if I could make a very good living with history, I would. And right now I'm taking in college, American history, I guess 2010. It's the pre-Columbian to right before the Reconstruction,
mm-hmm.
after the Civil War. And what I'm beginning to realize because of research papers I'm having to do is what we learn, at least in my age group, what I can remember from high school and junior high and even elementary school, what we're learning compared to what the actual history is. Like y'all said before, we learn, you know, the Disney version, you know, the Charlie Brown's Thanksgiving and, you know, Pocahontas and John Smith and all that, and how sugar-coated what we're taught, and yet our history is not like that. I mean, we didn't. One of the things I'm learning, my research paper for this semester is women of the pre-revolution and the revolution era, and what their impact was on the outcome. And what I'm learning is that, you know, which I already knew, we did not have Walmart back in the day where we could go and get all of, you know, all of our essentials, our groceries and our hygiene items. But learning how hard it was, and, you know, we think of if we have to skip a meal, you know, we're starving by dinner. But these people went, you know, days without being able to eat when they first got here.
Yes, they did. Amber, we're coming up on a break. If I may, just take it, and I appreciate your call very much, and I'm glad you listened there. Bernard Balin, does every culture do this? Turn its history into myth? Sand off the hard edges that you describe, as you describe here? Or is there something uniquely American in this?
Well, I think the problem of historical interpretation is a universal problem. And it's often and it's often written by the winners, and hence has its own triumphalism in it. But gradually, in my opinion, gradually in successive waves of historical interpretation and reinterpretation, we do come closer by cross criticism. We do come closer to what I would consider to be what happened. We never get it fully. We never get it perfect. But we try to come closer by criticism within the historical profession and the availability of new sources that weren't there before.
But maybe there's also always popular resistance to that because it's easier to run around with a pretty vision in our minds.
And then the problem for historians as such is to be able to get beyond that into a more coherent.
We have to take a short break. We'll come right back and get it. Professor Bernard Balin is with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking today about the real history, the early European settlement of America, the really tough years, certainly not the Disney version. My guest is the celebrated historian Bernard Balin. His book, out now in paperback, is The Barbarous Years, The Peopling of British North America, The Conflict of Civilizations, 1600 to 1675. He has written to great acclaim on many of the early years, centuries even, of American history, this time those very early settlements, and just how terribly hard it was. Starvation, disease, murder, wolves, arrows, even cannibalism. Bernard Balin, here's a question from Pat on Facebook. She notes that she was reading Charles Mann's 1493, where the author writes, as you write similarly, that 8 out of 10 English that arrived in Virginia in the early 1600s died. Says, please ask Professor Palin why he thinks that people kept coming when the chance of dying from disease or starvation of warfare was so incredibly high.
Well, they had hopes that they could survive in these circumstances and profit by it enormously. And in fact, many of them did. The deprivation came out of many sources. One is the acclimatization of the settlements, learning how to live in this land, and also to deal with the immediate problems they were faced with. But did
the reports get back to London that they were all dying?
There were conflicting reports. And, of course, there were political factors involved in this as well. Mm-hmm. And some were positive because they were promoting the colony.
Right.
Some were the opposite because they wanted to destroy the colony's organization as it then was and set it up in their own terms. Mm-hmm. But I want to say, if I can insert this at this point, history becomes so much more interesting the closer you get to the reality. For example, this silly myth about Pocahontas, who was supposed to have thrown herself and saved John Smith and so. Mm. The truth of that, when you get into, and anthropologists have helped us out in this, by the way, is really interesting. It has nothing to do with a 10-year-old girl running around an execution block. It was a ritual process by which Smith was being incorporated into the Indian community as a member of that community. And it was a ritual process which he didn't understand, and much of our historians have not understood. But the point is very interesting, that what was involved was to go through this ritual by way of introducing him into the larger Indian community.
Which was not an easy ritual.
Not at all. It was a difficult business.
Physically.
And he misunderstood it and became even more belligerent in his treatment of the native peoples. But the point is that the closer you get into these details, the more interesting it is. And so we were talking before about the Plymouth settlement and the pilgrims and so. What's so interesting about it to me at this point, and really that's the point of the chapter I wrote about this, is that in the eyes of their leader and the leadership group, William Bradford, their great governor and so, in fact, their prosperity was the destruction of the community. His life in his later years, he died in 1657, was a lamentation on what had happened to the original group.
The utopian ideal.
They had prospered, but that prosperity had drawn them farther and farther away on their individual farms, away from the local community. And there were foreign people, so to speak, who came into the group. There was crime he couldn't understand. And at the end of his life, he struggled to understand what had happened. Why didn't they stay together? Part of that answer is the prosperity of his people who went of goodwill, who went farther and farther from the central community. At the end of his life, which I found and I wrote about rather extensively in the book, at the end of his life, he tries to understand this. And one of his ways, and the chief way, was to study Hebrew, because he believed that God spoke to the angels in Hebrew, and it was God's language, and consequently, he might get closer to God for an understanding if he knew Hebrew. And so he was a good linguist by himself, by the way. But he then undertook Hebrew exercises, which I photographed in the book.
Yes, I saw.
Where he painfully writes out the Hebrew letters for English words. He has a vocabulary of 1,000 Hebrew words. And he concentrates on certain problems like how many Hebrew words are there for the name of God.
But it was a little late. His America had turned into something that he didn't anticipate,
well,
and it was inexorable.
Exactly right. It was beginning to prosper. And the prosperity joined with Massachusetts, the Puritans, who created, by the way, a big market for the Pilgrims' goods as they produced it. But for him, it was a source of lamentation.
Here's where I still feel the reverberations from this so keenly today, because you come with those utopian ideals, and the first thing they hit is struggle and suffering that in no small number of cases turns into every man for himself. A lot of the idealism is blown away just by the incredible challenge of survival. Right behind it, or before you know, comes prosperity or the chance at fortune. Between those two, you get the individualism in this tension with the utopianism, and here we are to this day.
Well, they struggled. One shouldn't exaggerate this. That is, there were many communities that were settled for very non-utopian purposes.
They were called companies for a reason.
Yes, and they were there for a profit, and they succeeded ultimately quite well. But the struggle was there at the beginning. And in the case of the Pilgrims, it's very poignant what happened at by the end of Bradford's life. Mm-hmm. And I've gone into this in some detail, not because the Pilgrims had a Thanksgiving, but because this is a utopian community whose prosperity was in fact a defeat of its initial principles.
Yes.
And that kind of paradox, it seems to me, comes out of a good deal of the history of this period.
You described the Pilgrims wading back and forth and back and forth from the Mayflower through the cold, cold waters just to try and get a toehold on land. Luke is calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Luke. You're on the air with Bernard Bailyn.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Bernard. I was just calling because, like the previous caller said, history is strange and when you learn it in your public or private schools, I guess, as a youngster. In Connecticut, it was always, we have colonists and the Indians, but even here in a small state like Connecticut, there was many different tribes. And there's a place in Guilford called Sachem's Head. And I looked into this, and it comes from a beheading of a Pequot leader. And the story goes that they left his head in an oak tree near the river's head there, and everyone called Sachem's Head from then. Previous to this, he was running away from the Mohicans and the Englishmen. And they had bound together, arrived at his encampment earlier that day or the day before, and basically slaughtered 400 Pequots as they started to rouse from their sleep. And it's just very strange to think how we go through, the celebration of Thanksgiving and the little thoughts about the buckles and everything, but it really, there was almost an entirety of many nations here, and I think that just the understanding of how these people were brought into false alliances against each other, and the horrible things that we promised in order to get things done. So the blood wasn't on our hands. And I think that some of these things go unknown, and I'm really happy to hear the discussion. I love his research. I'm looking forward to reading his work there. And thanks for the time.
Thank you, Luke, for calling. It is a wonderful work of history. I guarantee you'll enjoy it. Tough as some of it can be, I don't know the story of Sachem's Head in Gilbert, Connecticut, but it's of a piece with what you describe again and again. Absolutely barbaric clashes.
It is an offshoot of the Pequot War, so-called, mm-hmm. what the caller is referring to correctly. Mm-hmm. The Pequot War in 1637 in southern Connecticut was one of the most vicious and destructive episodes in this whole story where – and it has a special twist, which I'll mention in a minute. Mm-hmm. But it was in itself the annihilation of much, not all, but much of the Pequot tribes who were settled into a gated community which was set on fire. And how many hundreds of natives were burned alive, we still don't know.
And your twist, we just have half a minute, Professor.
Yeah. But The twist to this is that it was not isolated in the Puritans' mind. 1637 is the date of Anne Hutchinson and the antinomian controversy, which the establishment in Boston thought of as Antichrist. And the Pequots, they thought of as Antichrist as well. And consequently, to the fight itself was added the venom and fear of all their ideology, their religious and theological
conflict. Imagine the Native Americans could barely grasp themselves being caught up in the antinomian dispute and all the talk of Antichrist, what you describe as villages burning. Bernard Bailyn's book is The Barbarous Years, The Peopling of British North America, The Conflict of Civilizations, 1600 to 1675. Professor Bailyn, thank you so much for coming in. In a moment, remembering literary great Doris Lessing, this is On Point. Nobel Prize-winning author Doris Lessing died yesterday at her home in London. She was 94. Lessing was raised in the then British colony of southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, the setting of her first novel, The Grass is Singing. In 2007, she won the Nobel Prize in Literature for her life's work. Her loosely autobiographical 1962 novel, The Golden Notebook, was a landmark for its frank feminist perspective. In 2008, Doris Lessing spoke with me about her final book, Alfred and Emily, part fiction, part memoir, based on the lives of her parents. I asked her then about her reputation for being a bit prickly.
I didn't know I had a prickly reputation.
Oh, I read the clips. You do. I say it with respect.
Oh, that's okay. I don't mind being prickly. You know, I'm going to be 90 next year.
Yes, so be however you like.
I'm entitled.
Yes, indeed. I couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. What do you hear when you talk with listeners who read all the way back through your work, all the way back to The Golden Notebook? Is it an ongoing conversation that nourishes you? Does it trap you in past work? How do you look at it?
Well, The Golden Notebook is a sort of special thing. You know, you said that I got noticed for The Golden Notebook, but in actual fact, I got noticed for my first book, which was The Grass is Singing. I got extremely good reviews for it.
Yes.
As for the conversation with my readers, you know, I have a lot of different readers with different reactions. I do get quite a lot of letters, which are always astonishing because, you know, a book is not necessarily read as an author might think it should be read. And that's surprising. Because several times books I've written, it depends also on the country. You know, a book will be one thing in one country, let's say Italy, and another thing in France.
Depending on the audience.
Yes, you've got a different culture, different attitudes. So one has to be, just accept what comes, really. It's no good saying to a reader, this is not what I meant, because the book is no longer mine. It's somebody else's, you know. And you have to accept that.
Doris Lessing, through life, have you felt courageous or have you felt somehow just compelled by circumstance? How do you look at that?
No, you see, I think I was born pugnacious. It never has crossed my mind ever in my life to change what I want to say because it might upset anyone. And, I mean, you can criticize that as much as you like. It's a very, I suppose, it's a very egotistical thing. I think it's because from southern Rhodesia, you know, southern Rhodesia, no one even knows what it was. It was a British colony. I was a raw girl from southern Rhodesia. And when I first came to London, a lot of people were very ready to put me down on those grounds. So I got... naturally, my fists went up, and I fought back. And then, of course, The Golden Notebook was regarded, when it came out, as a difficult book. Incidentally, I'd like to say difficult. Last year, I'm walking in Hampstead,
yes,
and there are a couple of girls, about 15, bouncing along the pavement towards me, and they stop and say, Hi, Doris.
Yes?
We have just been doing the Golden Notebook. Wow, and off they bounce. So I was thinking, this book was supposed to be so difficult. Now 15-year-old girls say, wow. So I mean,
skipping through it.
It's very funny, actually. That, it's hilarious. But and so then I get letters about the Golden Notebook from all over the place. And they're always different, you see, because the Golden Notebook has been seen differently. Some people saw it entirely as a feminist crack track. Other people saw it as about madness. And interestingly, a lot of others saw it only politically. And now that's interesting. You know, a girl from ex-Yugoslavia says, oh, Doris, it was so interesting reading about those far-off times. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it's just the other day.
Nobel Prize-winning author Doris Lessing speaking with me in 2008. She died yesterday in London at 94. You can hear the whole interview at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.